And welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella. Concerts by the CSO on Friday, February 14th through Sunday, the 16th, feature guest conductor David Afkam and violin soloist Christian Tetzloff. The program includes Wagner's Prelude to Act 3 of Lohengrin, Violin Concerto by Sibelius, and after intermission, Pelléas and Mélisande by Arnold Schoenberg. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on the Sibelius Violin Concerto, a work lasting about 32 minutes. Unlike many composers who wrote famous violin concertos, Sibelius himself was a violinist. The violin was his first instrument, and his earliest composition was a little piece for violin and cello called Water Drops, which he wrote when he was 10. After he began serious violin study at the age of 14, he was hooked. The violin took me by storm, and for the next 10 years, it was my dearest wish, my overriding ambition, to become a great virtuoso. When he moved to Vienna in 1890 to study composition, Sibelius played in the conservatory orchestra and ultimately couldn't resist auditioning for the Philharmonic. He broke down and wept when he got back to his room, and then went to the piano and began practicing scales. Even as late as 1915, long after he had put the violin aside and was a highly regarded composer, he wrote in his diary, "Dreamt I was 12 years old and a virtuoso." Sibelius was a natural to write violin concertos, but in the end he wrote only one, and he spent enormous time and energy on it before he was satisfied. No doubt it was, in some deep sense, his own concerto, even though he would never attempt to play it. Perhaps this explains not only the great pains he took in writing the piece, but also the way he treated the man who had asked him for it. Willy Bormester had known Sibelius briefly in Finland before his career as a violin virtuoso took off. It was Bormester who persuaded Sibelius to write the concerto in the first place. The piece was tailor-made for him, and he assumed he would give the premiere. Sibelius began the score in 1902 and finished the completed draft in the autumn of 1903. He sent the work to Bormester, who responded, "Wonderful, masterly. Only once before have I spoken in such terms to a composer, and that was when Tchaikovsky showed me his concerto." But when Bormester suggested that he needed time to master the work, Sibelius hired Viktor Novacek, a musician of no particular distinction, who is remembered only for this one day in his life, to give the first performance. After the premiere, Bormester again offered to play the concerto, promising that all my 25 years of stage experience, my artistry and insight will be placed to serve this work. But Sibelius, who had extensively reworked the concerto, picked Karl Hollier, a former member of the Joachim Quartet, to give the premiere of the revised version in October 1905 under the baton of Richard Strauss. And when the score was published, it was dedicated to Ferenc von Fesi, a Hungarian violinist who was one of the concerto's first champions. The work Bormester inspired but never played is a violinist's dream. In fact, the first version was particularly criticized for the way the solo part consistently overshadowed the orchestra, and much of Sibelius' subsequent reworking tried to restore that balance. Still, from the very first measures, it is the solo voice rather than its dialogue with orchestra that commands our attention. In September 1902, Sibelius had written to his wife about a marvelous opening idea for the concerto. What he ultimately put on paper is truly unforgettable, with the violin entering almost at once on a sustained mezzo forte G, quite at odds with the orchestra's shimmering D minor. From there, the violin takes off on a long rhapsodic theme, allows the orchestra one extended statement of its own, and then banishes it entirely from the central development section, which Sibelius, against all tradition, treats as a brilliant cadenza. This is but one masterstroke in a bold and inventive design. Though less imaginatively conceived, the adagio is deeply haunting. A broad melody begins low in the violin register and then takes off. It is particularly lovely how Sibelius later accompanies that melody, now in the clarinet and bassoon, with pianissimo scales. Donald Tovey called the spirited finale a polonaise for polar bears. The folksy main theme over an excited drum beat comes from a very early string quartet that Sibelius did not publish. The way the violin dances around the melody, however, teasing in its insistent rhythms and recklessly walking the high wire, turns circus music into high art. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Sibelius Violin Concerto. And now on to Arnold Schoenberg's symphonic poem Pelléas and Mélisande, a work lasting about 44 minutes. In April 1902, Arnold Schoenberg met Richard Strauss, the widely famous composer of Don Juan, Death and Transfiguration, Till Eulenspiegel, Also sprach Zarathustra, Don Quixote, and most recently Ein Heldenleben, an outpouring of tone poems so great no one guessed it had already run its course. Schoenberg, with a young wife and 3-month-old baby at home, was struggling to make a living and had taken a job as a copyist. One of his first tasks was to prepare the parts for Strauss's new cantata, Taillefer, and so the two eventually met. Strauss often showed enormous sympathy to less fortunate composers, and he offered to take a look at the sprawling Gürrellieder Schoenberg was hoping to finish. We don't know what he thought of the extraordinary pages of Gürrellieder. They stretched the language and capacity of music as much as anything he himself had written, but he agreed to help Schoenberg and even found him a decent teaching job. Strauss also gave Schoenberg a copy of Maeterlinck's play Pelléas and Mélisande, suggesting that it would make a good opera. Debussy had thought that too, ever since the night he attended the premiere of the play in 1893, and his first opera appeared on stage the same month Strauss and Schoenberg met. Was either of them aware of Debussy's opera, today recognized as a landmark? Years later, in February 1950, when Schoenberg introduced a broadcast of his symphonic poem, he claimed, "I had first planned to convert Pelléas and Mélisande into an opera, but I gave up on this plan, though I did not know that Debussy was working on his opera at the same time." Now, whether this was really true or whether by 1950 Schoenberg's memory was shaky or merely conveniently loose with the facts, he did not proceed with his plan to write an opera. Long before 1950, Schoenberg also had erased the image of Richard Strauss from his memory, because within the decade after their first meeting, Strauss retreated from the brink of modern music for the comforts of the 18th century in his opera Der Rosenkavalier. Each chose his own path, and they were roads that would never meet. In 1913, Strauss wrote to Alma Mahler, "Only a psychiatrist can help poor Schoenberg now. He would do better shoveling snow instead of scribbling on music paper." The following year, when Schoenberg was asked to say something to honor Strauss's 50th birthday, he replied, "He is no longer of the slightest artistic interest to me, and whatever I may once have learned from him, I am thankful to say I misunderstood." The path Schoenberg chose in 1902, however, was one Strauss had cleared for him, the large orchestral tone poem. It wasn't entirely unfamiliar to Schoenberg because his Transfigured Night, written for string sextet just before the beginning of the last century, is in essence the same sort of music as Schoenberg himself acknowledged when he rescored it for full string orchestra in 1917. It was around 1900, Schoenberg later wrote, when Maurice Maeterlinck fascinated composers, stimulating them to create music to his dramatic poems. What attracted all was his art of dramatizing eternal problems of humanity in the form of fairy tales, lending them timelessness without adhering to imitation of ancient styles. By 1902, when Schoenberg took up the book Strauss gave him, Maeterlinck's Pelléas had attracted not only Debussy, who took nearly a decade to produce his opera, but also Gabriel Fauré, who wrote incidental music for an 1898 production in London. The advantage of Schoenberg's approach to Maeterlinck, the symphonic poem, is that unlike either Debussy's or Fauré's, it is not so dependent on the text and is free to make its own points. In his 1950 remarks, Schoenberg still expressed some regret that he did not make an opera of Pelléas. It would have differed from Debussy's. I might have missed the wonderful perfume of the poem, but I might have made my characters more singing. On the other hand, the symphonic poem helped me in that it taught me to express moods and characters in precisely formulated units, a technique which an opera would perhaps not have promoted so well. Schoenberg's symphonic poem is a single movement. In 1920, Alban Berg wrote an analysis showing how it is also a continuous four-movement symphony with a large sonata movement, a scherzo, a slow movement, and a finale that recapitulates much of the previous music. Maeterlinck's three main characters provide Schoenberg with his three central themes. Regarding the drama, Schoenberg said that he tried to mirror every detail of it with only a few omissions and slight changes in the order of the scenes. Perhaps, as frequently happens in music, there is more space devoted to the love scenes. The story is a simple triangle. The helpless, childlike Mélisande, Golod, who rescues and marries her, and Pelléas, Golod's younger stepbrother who falls in love with her. The emotions are complex and varied. Love, jealousy, betrayal, heartbreak, murder, and forgiveness coming too late. The tone is one of suggestion and unreality. Schoenberg spoke of the poem's perfume, and much of its greatness is that elusive. He nonetheless attempted to capture not only its character and atmosphere, but the deeper psychological meaning as well. As for Schoenberg's characters, even though wordless, they do sing. As the music opens, Schoenberg introduces fate in a four-note cry from the clarinet. Golod, pictured by a theme that first appears in the horns, discovers Mélisande in the forest. She is represented by a gentle descending melody that, like Mélisande herself, undergoes many changes in response to various events. Golod takes Mélisande to his castle to become his wife. Pelléas enters, contrasted distinctly by the youthful and knightly character of his motif, in Schoenberg's own words. And now the drama begins. As the scherzo opens, Mélisande plays with her wedding ring, tossing it in the air. It falls into the fountain. The scene where Mélisande lets her hair hang out of the window is richly illustrated, writes Schoenberg of a magical passage for flutes and clarinets imitating each other. When Golod leads Pelléas to the frightening and subterranean tombs, a musical sound is produced which is remarkable in many respects, especially because here, for the first time in musical literature, is used a hitherto unknown effect, a glissando of the trombones. The love scene for Pelléas and Mélisande is an expansive, ecstatic adagio. Eventually, Golod, who has been hiding in the shadows, rushes out and kills Pelléas. The finale begins as a recapitulation, and then, with the measured step of the servants, brings a premonition of the death of Mélisande, who has given birth to a daughter. An epilogue suggests transfiguration and closes with the music of fate. The premiere of Pelléas and Mélisande did not go well. Nearly half a century later, Schoenberg still remembered that reviews were unusually violent, and one of the critics suggested putting me in an asylum and keeping music paper out of my reach. The music he wrote for Pelléas and Mélisande fared even less well in the marketplace. In work after work, Schoenberg carved for himself an even more remote and difficult place, and one that casual listeners and egotistical performers have seldom wished to visit. Still, Schoenberg didn't give in or give up. As he wrote of Alban Berg, but would never have boasted of himself, making the belief in ideas one's own destiny is the quality which makes the great man. In 1948, he did write, by way of explanation, "I was not destined to continue in the manner of Transfigured Night or Guerrilleader or even Pelléas and Mélisande. The Supreme Commander had ordered me on a harder road." Program notes by Philip Huscher on Arnold Schoenberg's Pelléas and Mélisande. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.